Lecture 4, Prophecy and Science 1, Francis Bacon.
The apocalypse was by no means the exclusive property of the Protestants. It flourished in a number of Catholic areas, most outstandingly in the early 16th century, indeed in the late 15th century, in the Iberian kingdoms, Spain and Portugal. It never flourished, however, terribly well at Rome. Rome, even in late antiquity, the bishop there just didn't get excited at the idea of Antichrist and the end of days. Why was that? Because the apocalypse inherently qualifies the status quo. It inherently makes what we've got now possibly not what we're going to have tomorrow. Remember, as we've said, the apocalypse enables us to say, today may be one way, but tomorrow will be qualitatively different. That dimension, the qualification of the authority and the power of the Bishop of Rome, was something that never sat well with the popes. On this rock I will build my church. There were the keys of binding and loosing, and the apocalypse said, perhaps a different rock, perhaps a different set of keys. That was not, obviously, what the curia wanted to hear. And yet, for all of that, there were exceptions. The papacy could, at moments, find itself drawn up into apocalyptic expectations. After all, you will remember that Pope Lucius III was a big friend, supporter, and backer of no less than Joachim of Fiora. The Pope needed an official advisor on the apocalypse, and he got the best in Europe, without any doubt. Moreover, Joachim had talked about the idea of an angelic pope, and this would be picked up by the spiritual Franciscans in the later Middle Ages. We needed an angelic pope, a charismatic pope, a legal pope to be sure, but a pope who was not just an administrator of canon law, a pope who was not simply a great diplomat, a pope who was not simply a great politician. And for one brief moment, they had one. In 1294, a local Roman hermit, a fellow called Marone, became Celestine V. He was the spiritual pope, it seemed, that everyone was looking for. And, dare I say, he was an utter and complete disaster. He lasted 6 months. He simply, it seemed, couldn't be pope, he simply couldn't do the job, and he is the only pope in the history of Catholicism to have stepped down. It's known as the Great Refusal. It is thought, it's argued in a number of texts by serious scholars, that in fact his successor, Pope Boniface VIII, that's the one that Dante reserved a place in hell for, had run a tube down to the room of the young, relatively young pope, Celestine, Paul Marone, and through that tube, Boniface said, or the future Boniface, his name was Rudy Gaetani, he said, Celestine, this is God, oh my Lord. It's time to resign, Celestine. And indeed, Celestine did just that. However, you can't just have an ex-pope bouncing around Europe. That would be wrong. So poor old Celestine had to stay in jail. But there had been, at least for a while, one genuinely angelic pope. And the expectation was that there would be a series of others. There will be other angelic popes. He was the first. There would be a bad one, then two good ones. All sorts of numerological projections occurred. I want to suggest to you that these projections are still with us in contemporary Catholicism. There still is an apocalyptic dimension based on the papacy in the world today. But an apocalyptic pope, an angelic pope, was not normally what warmed the heart of the curia. But it did warm the heart of the people of Iberia in the most extraordinary ways. What events were necessary to have the run-up to the coming of Christ or to the millennium? what was necessary for the last judgment, for the end of time, and indeed the end of the world. Since late antiquity, people had pretty well agreed. There were two outstanding ones. There were a lot of others as well, but two were clearly outstanding. One was the conversion of the Jews. Paul, in Romans 11:25-26, had said, all Israel will be saved. Last, but they'll come in again. And two, he said this would happen once the fullness of the Gentiles had been attracted to and converted to Christianity. Once all the nations of the world had had an opportunity, they didn't all convert, but at least had had the opportunity, and if they said, no, thank you, well, that was their problem, but they had the opportunity to embrace Christianity, then the Nazarene would return. The full number of the Gentiles. The Christian word needed to go out to all nations, said the Revelation 7:9. The people of all races and all languages were, after all, to be a part of the heavenly kingdom. And both of these expectations related directly to the events associated with Spain and to some extent with Portugal. In 1492, what happened? Well, you're going to think of Columbus, and I'll talk about Columbus in just a bit, but three things happened, all of which were seen to be apocalyptic, seen to be later, but also by the participants at the time. Spain is doing just what one would expect at the end of days. It's launching Columbus to bring the gospel to Asia. It's expelling the Jews. You have an option in Spain in 1492 of either converting or leaving. And finally in 1492, the last Moorish principality, Granada, would be overthrown by the forces of the Catholic monarchs. And all of this, incidentally, happened within a few months. The expulsion of the Jews itself culminated a long history of physical attacks, a long history of pogroms, actually, on the Jewish community. What had been a remarkably vibrant community, had been there 800 years and more. In 1391, Dominican priests, led by a Father Vincent Ferrer, had led Christian mobs to force conversions. And in fact, they were successful. About 100,000 Jews converted to Christianity. Remember, the motivation of these assaults was not just that they didn't like Jews, but to get them to convert to the truth, because that conversion was necessary, it was a prerequisite for Christ to return. Similarly, the crusade against Granada, a bitterly fought war. It wasn't a pushover by any means. The overthrow of the last Muslim principality seemed to be bringing Christianity to the Gentiles. And Columbus is a witness of these events and an enthusiastic one. Our popular image of Columbus is what? Let's think for a minute. When you think of Columbus, what do you think of? A tough, hard-headed explorer. A man who said the world is round against the schmoes who said, no, it's flat. Everybody knew the world was round. They had known that for centuries. Thomas Aquinas uses the phrase, as sure as we know the world is round. That was not Columbus's discovery at all. The real issue is how big is the darn thing? And was it small enough to be viable to take the trip west to find the Indies? Now, if you compare the figures, it seems pretty clear that the professors were right and that Columbus was wrong. The professors had a much more accurate, in fact, remarkably accurate idea of the circumference of the globe, and Columbus shrunk it down for his purposes. But if we look at the historical Columbus, there's even some evidence that he fudged his figures because he wanted to make the trip. He fudged these figures because he had this burning mission. Columbus collected a huge book of prophecies for his own personal use, and he was particularly impressed with Joachim. According to at least one Joachite tradition, the Christian conqueror of the Holy Land would come from Spain. And according to Columbus, he does the sacred numbers. He is convinced that the world will end in about 150 years. And during that time, it may seem like a lot to you, a whole lot has to be accomplished. That's the point. He wants to go east to bring the word to the Gentiles. He wants to go east to make money. But he wants to go east to make money so that he can fund a crusade to capture the Holy Land, another prerequisite for Christ's return. Christopher Columbus was a deeply, deeply religious man. He went on fasts regularly and observed every Orthodox fast day. His language was loaded with piety all the time. He constantly invoked God and the saints. He even dressed like a Franciscan tertiary, and on his deathbed he became one. He set up a fund of the money he made from the New World in Genoa, and the purpose of the fund was to finance the Crusades to the Holy Land. He exults at the conquest of Granada in southern Spain, the last Muslim stronghold, the last Muslim entity. And he talks about watching the Christian banners now flying from the great fortress of Malaga. This really excites the pants off him. He exults at the expulsion of the Jews at virtually the same time. As he says in his diary, so after having expelled all the Jews from the kingdoms and dominions, in the same month, the kings commended me with a suitable fleet to the region of India. This is a trip to fulfill prophecy. This is a trip to realize the sacred word. Columbus wants the Catholic monarchs to continue their crusade. After Granada, the Muslims should be expelled from North Africa, and Jerusalem should be reconquered. Necessary for the end of days, a part of Jericho tradition. And King Ferdinand, by the way, really quite liked being referred to somewhat prematurely, indeed altogether prematurely, as the King of Jerusalem. The monarchs took Columbus seriously. It wasn't just some sort of quirk. They thought he was right. But they had a problem with the outrageous demands that he made. Admiral of the Ocean Sea, the lands he discovered to be his in perpetuity, that was outrageous by the standards of the age. The purposes of the voyage to make money, this doesn't necessarily conflict with religion, and to fund the Middle Eastern campaign. God and gold go together. This enterprise was undertaken, said Columbus, with the purpose of spending whatever accrued from it in restoring the Holy Sepulchre to the Holy Church. Having gone there and seen the land, I wrote the king and queen, my lords, that within 7 years I would finance 50,000 foot soldiers and 5,000 horsemen in the conquest. In other words, he wants to bring Christianity to Asia from both ends. Columbus was enormously impressed with Psalm 18, where it says, Thou dost establish me as the head of the nations. People that I have not known serve me. As soon as they hear me, they submit to me. And also Psalm 22. All the end of the world will remember and turn unto the Lord. The clans of the nation will worship before him. The kings belong to the Lord. He rules over the nations. Columbus's entire enterprise was suffused with the apocalypse. The expectation is that that would be a crucial step in bringing the second coming. Columbus also expected, it's recorded in his Book of Prophecies, that after you had conquered the Middle East and brought Christianity to Asia, there would be a brief struggle with Gog and Magog, and he records the prophecies in Ezekiel and Daniel in his Book of Prophecies in complete detail. He records the whole thing. Columbus came to think that maybe he, as he started doing these things with his voyages, that maybe he was a prophetic figure personally. He made a play on his name, Christopher, as Christopherens, the bearer of Christ. There's actually an illustration of him on a map as such. He played on the name Columbus. Columbus translated into Latin with some effort, but you can do it, as dove, associated with the third figure in the Trinity, and it seems with the third Joachite age. Columbus thought himself a divine instrument, and he said with a level of chutzpah, as we say in the East, that was truly remarkable, God made me the messenger of the new heaven and the new earth, of which he spoke in the Apocalypse of St. John. And after having spoken it by the mouth of Isaiah, he showed me the spot where to find it. This man can only see his world. This man, hard-headed navigator, good sailor, can only understand what he's doing and can only be funded for what he's doing within the phrase and framework of the Apocalypse. When he names places in the New World, what does he call them? Trinidad, as in Trinity. Isla Sancta, Holy Island, Gracia, Grace. Serpent's Mouth, the Dragon's Mouth. There is no Ferdinandsville. There is no Virginia named after Elizabeth. Nothing of the sort. After the third voyage, he came to believe that the Orinoco River in Panama was one of the four rivers of Eden. The district of Veriga in Panama, a region where David and Solomon had extracted their precious stones. In other words, the voyage of Columbus is pulling the whole world together. You put together all the prophecies, all the expectations. It's all part of a single package. But Columbus and the king and the queen were not alone. All kinds of Spaniards were obsessed with this sort of thing. Cardinal Ximenes wanted to create a pure Catholic Christianity in preparation for Christ's return. With the help of Jewish converts, he organizes a massive polyglot Bible involving all the languages used at the time when it was written. It's an extraordinary undertaking, a piece of scholarship, of humanist scholarship, by the way, of remarkable proportions. And the point was this: we want to have the true faith in the language of Christ when he returns. He shouldn't have to learn Spanish. He can read it in the language he spoke. This is to get real truth. Now, Cardinal Ximenes might well have Jewish converts working in his, basically, in his school, but he was also violently anti-Jewish. No compromise with Judaism. It had to go. It would be no part of the Christian world. He would protect converts from the Inquisition so long as they appeared sincere. He would adopt Judaic ideas in preparing a translation, but Judaism had to go. He was also utterly intolerant of Muslims. And for the same reason, there had been a grace period after the fall of Granada. He had 20 years to convert, realizing changing from one religion to another, it was thought, is not an easy thing. 20 years to do this? No, says Ximenes. They have to do it now. They have to become Christians now. There is no toleration. In the Iberian kingdoms, both Spain and Portugal, the more apocalyptic you are, the more you see yourself in the latter days, the more anti-Semitic you also are. It correlates almost 100%. Earlier in the 15th century, and certainly in the 14th century and before, there had been coexistence, not toleration, but coexistence between the three religions, Islam, Christianity, and Judaism. No more. No more in the coming era. Now, I want to contrast this. I'm going to talk about this later on in the course. The irony is, in the British kingdoms, in Scotland and England, the more apocalyptic you are, the more you really think the end of the world is at hand, the more you turn out to be not anti-Semitic, but pilo-Semitic. In other words, apocalypticism can lead to the horror of religious persecution, utter persecution, while at the same time, it lays the foundations for modern toleration. The conquest of the Americas by the Spaniards was spectacular. It seemed to confirm everything. Cortes and Pizarro and all of these people were really bringing in the fullness of the Gentiles, it seemed, as early as the 1520s. Moreover, the Franciscans in the New World were given remarkable power in the Americas, and they had the feeling that there would be the millennial kingdom. However screwed up Spain might be, however absolute a mess Europe might be, in the New World with these new Indian Christians would be Christ's real society, and Christ might return there. There were even Franciscans who made the suggestion, this didn't play well in Rome, but they made the suggestion that the Pope should pack his bags and move to the New World where the millennial kingdom would be. Why not the Pope in Bolivia, I say, or Paraguay? This was an extremely authoritarian society, but it was also extremely millenarian. the great Habsburg, who was king of Spain and about a third to a half of Europe, Charles V, who inherits all of these domains, seemed to be the last world emperor. Ah, the last world emperor at last. He inherited vast domains, a huge conglomerate, and the prospect of the final Catholic monarchy seems to be at hand. Here was the latter-day Charlemagne in the figure of Christ. Here was exactly what you would expect at the end of days, and the vast ocean of prophecy about Charles is unbelievable. But there were problems. You know what these problems were. There was Luther and heresy at the same time. There was the Turkish advance on Vienna in 1529. This, in fact, gave Protestantism a chance. Moreover, all of these converts sitting down there in New Spain, and soon in Portugal as well, were they real? Did they have their fingers crossed? There is a feeling that within Spain itself there is a fifth column. That's actually Franco's phrase from the 1930s. A fifth column of fake Christians just waiting to blow the place away. In other words, the Iberian kingdoms have spectacular success, and at the same time, they are obsessed that it's not quite going to come off. We've got all these ex-Jews who might still be Jews. These Marranos, these swine, and they're everywhere. Remember, the Jewish community in Iberia was a community loaded with intellectuals. They would soon go into the church. The Muslim population was much more less of a threat because they tended to be servants. Maybe the Jews will take over through the Catholic Church. Can you imagine? Suppose the Pope turned out to be a Jew. My God, not a happy thought indeed, too horrible to contemplate. The Converso population, for their part, had three possibilities. On the one hand, a genuine conversion, which would indeed enrich Catholic piety with all kinds of mysticism. There were people genuinely confused about what they were forced to adopt. They really didn't understand Christianity, and after a while they weren't sure what Judaism was either. And one of the consequences of that are people who begin to think there is no doctrine and no church that has the right answer. They are native Spanish speakers. They are as Hispanic as anyone would want to be. They're trying very hard to be Catholic, but it doesn't translate quite as easily. And maybe all doctrine and all confessions are false. And finally, they're the crypto-Jews, who are Christians upstairs and Jews in the basement. The problem becomes a concern with maybe no dogma is right, and there is an awful lot of hypocrisy in the world today. This would lead in Spain, tragically, to a rise of racism. If you had Jewish blood, there was always the possibility that you were not a real Christian, and that in fact you would subvert the kingdom. And there are all sorts of racial laws that are introduced in the 16th century to keep people of Jewish blood out. This is one of the roots to modern racism. Philip II in 1556 says, "All the heresies sold in Spain, sown in France, sown in Germany, are all done by the descendants of the Jews. There's something about being Jewish that leads to subversion." And the Inquisition would constantly seek both legal, political, and fiscal limitations on the new Christians. In addition, there was the revolt of the Netherlands, there was the problem with Elizabeth, and finally, it comes to a head in the early 17th century. It comes to a head how, with the 30 Years' War, when Spain undertakes to take back Europe. In Portugal, there would be a mass conversion of Jews done all at one moment in 1597. The conversion of the Jews, one cup of water, King Manuel goes, and now you're all Christians. The result of that was a lot of crypto-Jews who turn up all over the place and do all sorts of interesting and almost always heterodox things. Okay? Portuguese Jews are even more subversive than the Spanish ones. Okay? It would lead Portugal to seek out the fullness of the Gentiles, crusades in North Africa, the trade to China and India and Brazil, all of which were important to this. But probably the most interesting, or in some ways the most interesting, was King Sebastian, raised by the Jesuits in an austere military environment. He would launch a great army personally against the Moors in Morocco. And he walked into a trap, and he and virtually his entire army was wiped out. The catastrophe, one of the great military disasters in Portuguese history, the catastrophe was so bad, people said, he's not dead. No, that's just the report. He's not dead. He's out there, maybe he's out there in the hills praying. He's at Avalon. He's on the Blessed Islands. He is the once and future king. Sebastian will come back. Sebastian will come back, reunite Portugal, and indeed, maybe save the world. There are all kinds of Sebastian pretenders. The Sebastianists would be important in the revolt of Spain against 1640, and Spanish domination. And there would be Sebastianists even in the 19th century in the Miguelite Wars, looking for the return of Sebastian. So we have an extraordinary thing when we look at Iberia. An apocalyptic culture that seeks to understand its conquest of the New World. It gives the ideology of the conquest of the New World, that seeks to eliminate heterodoxy and minorities within society. And I want to suggest that the apocalypse does this. It underwrites both humanity at its best and human horror at its worst. Let's go on from that to look at something, as they would say in Monty Python, something completely different. Let's talk about magic and science. There was that in Spain, but this is a little bit different. I want to look at Francis Bacon, Tomasa Campanella, science, salvation, and sexuality. What is magic? Let's see if we can explain this quickly. The year, 1460, the place, the city of Florence. The person, Cosimo de' Medici, aristocrat, banker, and frankly, thug. He has just gotten his hands on some of the most exciting documents in the world. Coming out of Constantinople just before its fall via Macedonia is what's called the Corpus Hermeticum, written by an extraordinary figure called Hermes Trismegistus. Who is Hermes Trismegistus? There is no Hermes Trismegistus, but he was thought to be a great seer, a contemporary of Moses. He writes a book of primal magical wisdom, the Prisca Theologica, as they would call it. What it did, it was like Christianity in some ways, and in fact was written in late Roman antiquity, not way back with Moses. What it did was stress the idea that Christianity could work and should be understood as a cognitive act. We need to know in order to be saved. We are looking for special knowledge. We are looking for a special knowledge that's mystical, and it's part of a dense fabric of magical traditions. Magic does not come out of a top hat, which is, I suspect, your image of it. Magic is seeing the world as a web of hidden forces. Vital energies underlying everything, emanating especially from the skies. There are all kinds of things about magic. Magic is fascinated by light. The man who's going to translate this for Cosimo, a fellow called Marsilio Ficino, was both a philosopher and a magician. And when he talks about light, he positively froths. God has placed his tabernacle in the sun, says Marsilio Ficino. The sun can signify God to you, says Marsilio Ficino. And Marsilio had a most interesting student, a man called Nicholas Copernicus. And Nicholas Copernicus did what? He proposed the heliocentric system. He was solving mathematical problems, but he took the radical hypothesis to solve the mathematical problems of the motion of the planets and the stars by positing the sun at the center. And when he writes about the sun at the center, he almost goes berserk. He says, in the middle of all sits the sun enthroned. In this most beautiful temple, could we place this luminary in any better position from which he can illuminate the whole at once? He is rightly called the lamp, the mind, the ruler of the universe. Hermes Trismegistus, names him the visible God. Sophocles, Electra, calls him the all-seeing. So the planet sits as upon a royal throne, ruling his children, the planets that move around him. So we have light as a mystical quality. It's the simple that gives visual reality to the entire universe. Another preoccupation of magicians was, in fact, number and proportion. They're mystical numbers, mystical ratios. Which ones are these? The unison, the octave, the fourth, and the fifth, going back a very, very long way. Mathematical relationships are how God thinks. And this would be picked up. A man who utterly rejected magic and yet wanted to find mystical relations in the structure of the cosmos, a fellow called Johannes Kepler, a Lutheran, Central Europe, largely at Prague, who proposes the formula for the ellipse, for all the planets. Have we not got that ratio, that magic ratio, for the whole structure of the universe? So we have light, we have proportion, and then we have another thing called spiritus. Spiritus, a common idea. It connects body and mind, spirit and matter. Super refined matter, or, if you will, a coarse form of spirit. It mediated the physical and mental worlds. It's the stuff that gets your thoughts to move your body. Pure mind can't push matter. Pure matter can't affect the mind. You need this intermediary thing called spiritus, a kind of semi-spirit, a kind of souped-up matter to connect the two. John Donne writes poetry about it. He calls spiritus, it's a wonderful line actually, that subtle knot that makes us man. That otherwise, without spiritus, your brain is a great prince lying in a prison of your body. That's what's important. It's important, we use the phrase today, you have your spirits rising, that comes out of spiritus. You have a shot of whiskey, that's spirits, those are spirits, right? It sort of warms you, gets things moving, that's the idea of spirits. Spiritus was a single substance. You could have coagulated knots of spiritus, you could have it emanating out in more thin ways. The universe increasingly, and this is what's crucial, is made of the same stuff. It's not mind, matter, but an intermediary stuff called spirit. There is a world soul, an animus mundi, and we're all a part of it. Spiritus and the idea of the spirit could be very, very primitive. You get a wound from a knife, you put some salve on the knife to fix the wound because of the bad vibes. That's pretty primitive. But it could be very sophisticated. Take a magnet, put a piece of paper over it, sprinkle over iron filings, and you will see the hidden forces. Okay? Chemical bonding. There is something chemical about magic. And finally, in addition to light, power, spiritus, is probably the most important part of magic. Magic has to do with power. You want action. You want to manipulate objects through an understanding of their spirits. It's not like the great chain of being. Magicians don't reflect and categorize. They manipulate and control. And that's why it's so big in the Italian city-states. That's why these Italians are so... Because you're in a world where you haven't got the great chain of being obtaining. What is Genesis for the magician? It's an alchemical textbook. You get into your... Again, think of, I don't know, Boris Karloff. You go to your laboratory. And there in your laboratory, you duplicate what God did at Genesis. And you get something of his power, something of his mind. This is to replicate the separation that God did, and it is to become godlike in the process. Magicians want to pour spiritus into statues and make them, animate them literally, and make them move. Power, manipulation, engagement with nature. These are the attitudes of the magician, and it is, quite frankly, one of the sources of experimental science. The problems with this... You don't need a clergy to do it. Salvation is potentially in this world. And in the eyes of his enemies, what is the magician? He is Faust. How does magic relate to the apocalypse? Well, there's certain similarities. Both validate this world. Both validate human activity and human action. Mortalism seems to fit in with both. But there are important differences as well. Magic emphasizes secrecy, personal experience, private knowledge. Your lab technicians don't make the trip with you when you do the great alchemical act in your laboratory. Magical texts are deliberately obscure because why? Because you don't want the schnooks to get into this very arcane knowledge, right? Magic lacks social implications. It's an altogether private affair, altogether isolated in your study. The apocalypse, however, is the programmatic of human history. Universal implications, inherently political implications. Empires, rulers, religions, political power, the second coming, all being judged. What I want to suggest to you is that, in fact, in the 1590s through about 1620, there is a new millenarianism that embraces magic. And the consequences are extraordinary. Increasingly, we don't have the millennium from 300 to 1300, but a future millennium. A future millennium. Thomas Brightman in England, whose work is enormously influential, it's not really appreciated today how he shapes 17th century England, how he shapes Milton and so many writers of the period. Tommaso Campanella in Italy, Tobias Hess and a number of others in Germany, Johannes Boreas in Sweden, the tutor to Gustavus Adolphus, James Maxwell in Scotland, Abraham Cohen Herrera in the Jewish congregation in Amsterdam, all are mixing the apocalypse with magic. They expect a new order. It's not by accident. The first Faust book appears in 1587, subsequently in the next decade to be translated into Dutch, English, and French. It's the high point of academic astrology in Germany. There is fascination with mysticism, Neoplatonism, and the Jewish Kabbalah. The program for science. We have these pseudo-scientific, or not pseudo, they are scientific, but magico-scientific societies of Francis Bacon, Campanella, Andreae, and even Freemasonry in Scotland. We want to change magic with the apocalypse. The apocalypse makes magic something different. The apocalypse makes magic not a private undertaking, but a public undertaking. Magic is now associated with social reform, eschatology, social revolution. Magic is made public. Magic is transformed. It must be shared. Magic is made collective, and thus it's no longer the old magic. Magic is made political and thus demystified. Why? Because if I do this in my laboratory, in the collective redemption, you've got to be able to do it in your laboratory, or it doesn't count. The apocalypse changes the private character of magic into something public. It changes personal salvation into historical redemption, individual gnosis to community knowledge, the web of mysterious forces into public verification. Through the apocalypse, a collective understanding, undertaking for collective redemption makes magic a public act. That's a new mentality. Let me talk quickly about Francis Bacon and Tommaso Campanella. Francis Bacon, in some ways, the key founder to the program of modern science, the son of a low-level aristocrat, quite successful at court, at least up until 1621, when he was impeached for taking bribes. Francis Bacon said, well, yes, I took bribes. It didn't influence me, however, but that didn't impress the House of Commons at all. He spent all of his time writing about the philosophy of science and the program for science. His significance for science and the history of science is not any great discovery. It's not the inductive method. The inductive method that he proposes anticipates a kind of mathematics in the 18th century of Condorcet, something that would be pursued by John Stuart Mill in the 19th century and ultimately resolved by Bertrand Russell in our own century. Bacon's place in science is its program. The experiment as a public undertaking. Bacon is the heir to pre-Socratic atomism, Renaissance magic, and the apocalypse. Bacon rejects the easy manipulation of symbols and amulets of magic. He rejects the irrationality of incommunicable mysticism. He says it's full of error and vanity. It doesn't mean anything. He doesn't like secrecy. He wants to make it public. And when you make it public, you suddenly discover you're making it science. Bacon believes spiritus underlies the visible world. Everything, he says, everything tangible, that is, that we are acquainted with contains an invisible and intangible spirit which wraps and clothes as a garment. There's spirit in everything. It's a rarefied body akin to air, though differing from it. Science, he says, is action in power. He emphasizes man's engagement with nature. He says, I am laboring to lay the foundation, not of any sect or doctrine, but of human utility and power. He wants to command nature in action. He wants to make it work. He emphasizes the mechanical arts. Act in a way by growing ever more perfect. If you get something in mechanics, it gets better. You get something in the liberal arts, it's always the same. He wants to have action. He wants to have action that people take collectively. The mechanical arts improve through time, as the liberal arts do not. It's still working in the workshop. Now, what kind of time is available? The only kind of time available to Francis Bacon is apocalyptic time, is sacred time. What you do with science, it's a religious act for Bacon. You restore man to his original state. What you're doing through science is fulfilling the prophecy of Daniel 12:4. In the latter days, men will run to and fro, and knowledge will increase. The prophecy of Daniel, the flourishing of knowledge, is what's happening in these days. And that is the prelude to man's redemption. Science is human redemption. Connected with it, the circumnavigation of the globe and human redemption are linked with one another. We undertake this publicly. It's the great motto of Francis Bacon is Daniel 12:4. In the latter days, men will run to and fro, and knowledge will increase. A new foundation, a new basis is what he wants. Something totally different from what is simply a restoration of the past. He writes a book called The New Atlantis, a community founded, an ideal community founded on the scientific revelation. What happens? It's discovered by lost English sailors beyond Europe, beyond the Pillars of Hercules, beyond North and South America. It's a place called Ben Salem, unknown to the world, and yet it knows the world because it sends out secret missionaries to see what everybody is doing. And its knowledge is about to be revealed to the world. It will be published. Ben Salem is the scientific revelation, the offspring of peace and completeness, man completed as redemption. Knowledge of nature, circumnavigation of the globe, literally brings it together. Jerusalem was the promise and the old dispensation. It was Israel, it was Solomon. Ben Salem is the fulfillment, the new dispensation. That is science, and hopefully King James, the sixth and first. Science, Christianity, and salvation are all aspects of the same thing. At Ben Salem, what does he meet? He meets the people of the town of Renfusa. In the town of Renfusa, which simply means sheep-like, there we've got people guided by the revelation of science. He meets a priest scientist who comes to town, and the priest scientist brings a big crook, and he's talking about this great house of science, this great laboratory. It's Solomon's house, not named after Solomon, named after a legislator there. It's brought together by joining people together in the public undertaking of science and thus the redemption of man. And the final thing about the New Atlantis of Francis Bacon. Now, this is the sexual part. He meets, of all things, a third person, not just the leader of the town, not just the head of the scientific community that governs the island. He meets a man called Joe Aubin. Joe Aubin is described as the wisest man in Ben Salem, and he's Jewish. Now, that's very odd. Ben Salem is a Christian country, and yet it's got a Jew and a Jewish community in it. The Jews and the Jewish wisdom are going to be part of the final truth that emerges through human interaction in science. There is an apocalyptic dimension to the discovery of the Jews in Ben Salem. And what's more, we have in Ben Salem, remember how magic validates bodies, the apocalypse validates bodies. Well, you validate bodies in Ben Salem in the most literal way. That is to say, you get a prize, an award, for having 30 children by being fruitful and multiplying. And when you get married, there are special Adams and Eve pools where you get to see each other. You get no surprises when you get married, right? It all works out. Bodies are essential. Moreover, the kingdom of David, the kingdom of David and his associate in the Bible, you may remember, again, I'm teaching you Bible stories, is Joab. And what happens to David's kingdom? It encounters the prophecy of Nathan. David fancies a lady, a wife of a friend taking a bath. A wife of a friend who he looks at, desires, and it leads to problems for the Davidic kingdom. What you've got with science is the validation not just of the physical world, but of the sexual world. We are undoing the curse of Nathan. What we are doing, science involves desire. It involves eros. The validation of people as erotic, erotic, emotional, and passional beings is crucial to science itself. Bacon is one of the earliest thinkers who says reason need not repress the passions need to interact with one another. The passions have an autonomous validity. The passions are crucial to science and salvation.